Have you ever played like a really complicated board game where you just commit entirely to playing by the rules?
Oh, yeah, like you actually read the manual cover to cover.
Right. You study the rule book, you make all the right moves, you wait your turn patiently. But then, as the game drags on, you realize the person who owns the board just keeps changing those rules right as you're about to succeed.
Which is incredibly frustrating.
Exactly. And eventually, this really suffocating realization sets in. Doing everything right, playing perfectly by their rules to fix the game is exactly what's crushing you.
Yeah, that is a horrible feeling.
It is. You're just left staring at the board wondering what happens now.
Ugh.
Like when patience simply becomes a polite word for surrender, what do you actually do?
I mean, that right there is a profound psychological breaking point. And welcome to our deep dive. We are thrilled you're here with us today.
We really are. We have a fascinating mission today. We're unpacking a highly curated set of notes and audio excerpts dissecting Jose Rizal's explosive 1891 novel, El Filibusterismo.
And we really aren't just looking at a piece of classic literature today. We are examining the very anatomy of radicalization.
Right.
We're going to explore, the creation of a protagonist who completely embraces terror, the painful rejection of peaceful reform, and a chilling real-world irony that ultimately costs the author his own life.
It is such a heavy, gripping ride. And just as a quick disclaimer before we really get into it, because our source material deals with some very heavy political themes of revolution and colonialism today.
Yes, definitely worth mentioning.
We are exploring these ideas entirely through Rizal's psychological lens. We're doing this impartially. Obviously, neither of us is taking political sides or endorsing violence here.
Yeah.
We just want to convey the incredibly intense ideas presented in the original text.
Absolutely. Our goal is just to map out the psychology that the sources lay out.
Okay, let's unpack this. Even the title of this book is like a loaded weapon, El Filibusterismo. I mean, it feels weighty.
It really does.
And according to our sources, that's because the root word, filibustero, wasn't just some casual insult in the colonial vocabulary of the 19th century Philippines.
No, not at all.
It was a slur. It
Yeah.
meant a subversive, a dangerous traitor. Essentially, it was the colonial government's word for a terrorist.
Yeah, it was the ultimate institutional weapon of the era. I mean, once the authorities branded you a filibustero, your life as you knew it was just over.
Wow.
The mechanism of it was terrifyingly simple. It bypassed all legal defense, so your property could be seized, your family could be targeted, and your rights were completely forfeit.
That is terrifying.
It really was. It was a label specifically designed to silence literally anyone the government found inconvenient.
Which makes Rizal's choice to put that exact word on the cover of his book such a brilliant, defiant taunt.
Oh, absolutely.
He takes this horrific, life-ruining slur and just owns it. He's looking right at the colonial government saying, "Oh, you call us the criminals. Let me show you what a real criminal looks like. And more importantly, let me show you how you created him."
It's an incredible act of literary reclamation, but to fully understand the sheer fury radiating from that title, we have to look at the incredibly harsh reality of Rizal's own life while he was writing it.
Right.
He was working on this manuscript across Europe in 1891, and he was in a deeply dark, desperate place. I mean, he was completely broke, heartbroken, and stranded so far from home.
The notes highlight this deeply sad, almost agonizing detail about his struggle, actually. He ultimately gets the book printed in Ghent, Belgium. And, he didn't go to Belgium for the scenery.
No, definitely not.
He went because the printing presses were cheaper there. He was literally pawning his own personal belongings piece by piece just to afford the ink and paper to finish the print run.
And we really have to ask why he was so broke. It wasn't just poor financial planning or something. It was because back home in the Philippines, the colonial system was actively retaliating against his family. Yeah, they were stripping them of their lands and deeply persecuting them, all because of his earlier writings. So Rizal is starving in these freezing European rooms, entirely helpless to stop the suffering of the people he loves most.
That is so agonizing.
It is. And that immense emotional toll perfectly explains the stark tonal shift in his writing. His first novel, which he wrote years earlier, was full of earnest hope for reform.
Right, it was optimistic.
Exactly. But the second book is furious, and that fury is cemented right in the dedication. He dedicates El Filibusterismo to Gomburza.
That's the three Filipino priests, right? Gomez, Burgos, and Zamora.
Exactly. Back in 1872, the colonial government executed these three priests using the garrote. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the mechanism behind their execution is crucial to understand.
Okay, how so?
Well, these priests weren't violent rebels at all. They were just advocating for the equal rights of native clergy. But the government was terrified of any unified local influence, so they fabricated these flimsy charges of mutiny just to frame them.
Wow, just entirely made up.
Entirely. It was a blatant, highly public execution designed to just terrorize the populace into submission.
And Riesel was just an 11-year-old boy when that happened, seeing three innocent men executed by the state just for asking for equality. I mean, that doesn't just scare a kid, it permanently alters their DNA.
It really does. It leaves a permanent scar.
It completely sets the boiling temperature of this novel,
Yeah.
a powder keg waiting for a spark. Which actually leads us right to the protagonist. So, 13 years have passed in the narrative timeline since Riesel's first book.
Right.
In that first book, we had this hopeful, idealistic young reformer named Ibarra, but he is presumed dead at the start of this one. Everyone thinks the river claimed him.
But he survived. And the transformation is absolute. The hopeful reformer is just gone. He returns to the Philippines completely disguised as a man named Simon. And Simon is everything Ibarra was not. He is a fabulously wealthy, cold, entirely mysterious jeweler.
And he hasn't just returned to hide, right? Based on the notes, he has effectively infiltrated the very top of the food chain.
Oh, totally.
He uses his vast wealth and mysterious aura to worm his way right into the inner circle of the exact same colonial officials who destroyed his life in the first place. He becomes the most trusted, indispensable advisor to the most corrupt people in the land.
He is operating entirely as a sleeper agent, and
Well,
he has two massive obsessions driving him. First, he wants to rescue the love of his life, Maria Clara. She had hidden herself away in a convent after the tragedies of the first book.
okay.
And second, he wants to trigger a completely violent, tear it all down nationwide revolution.
But his strategy for triggering that revolution is what's truly unsettling here. Normally, if someone infiltrates a corrupt government, you'd expect them to sabotage it from the inside, right?
Like a traditional spy.
Yeah, to maybe try and pass secret reforms or at least assassinate the worst offenders. But Simon doesn't fight the corruption, he actively feeds it.
It is a genuinely chilling methodology. Simon employs a strategy known as accelerationism.
Acceleration.
Yeah. So, as the trusted advisor, he constantly whispers into the ears of these corrupt officials. When they want to pass a harsh tax, he tells them to double it. When they want to exploit local laborers, he encourages them to be even crueler.
Wow.
He actively advises the government to just squeeze the everyday people until they bleed.
It's like imagine there's a grease fire in your kitchen, and instead of grabbing an extinguisher, you grab a massive bottle of cooking oil and dump it right onto the flames.
That is a perfect analogy.
You are intentionally trying to burn the entire house down to the foundation, just hoping that the sheer heat and destruction will finally convince everyone to build a new house. The collateral damage of the people trapped inside the burning building doesn't even factor in for him.
It really doesn't. And that grease fire analogy perfectly captures the danger of accelerationism. Simon believes that if he makes the suffering of the public unbearable enough, the people will eventually have no psychological choice left but to explode into a violent revolt. He is deliberately manufacturing misery so that it acts as a fuse. And what makes Rizal's writing so masterful here is that he doesn't just write Simon off as a cartoon villain.
No, he makes him very complex.
Exactly. He forces you, the reader, to sit with the deeply uncomfortable temptation of that strategy.
It really is a temptation, though. Whenever anyone looks at a deeply broken, endlessly corrupt system, there is always that dark, cynical little voice that says, "Stop trying to fix the small leaks. You're just propping up a rotten structure. Let it completely collapse."
Precisely. Simon is the physical embodiment of that cynical voice.
Yeah.
He argues that trying to reform a fundamentally evil system just prolongs the suffering.
Right.
But to truly understand why Simon's dark, fiery plan might actually appeal to the masses, we have to look at the alternative. We have to look at what happens to the people in this society who are still trying to use the fire extinguisher, the ones trying to do things the quote-unquote right way.
Which brings us to Basilio. Now, if you remember the first book, Basilio was this innocent little altar boy who went through absolute hell. He lost his brother, his mother went mad, his life was completely destroyed.
Yeah, his backstory is heartbreaking.
It really is. But somehow he survived. And now, in this second book, he is a young man. He's a very promising, earnest medical student. Basilio and his peers represent the pure, untainted hope of the new generation. They haven't given in to Simon's cynicism at all.
And this generation has a demand. But we need to look really closely at what they are asking for, because it is not some radical, violent demand.
No, it's arguably the most modest request you could possibly make of a government. Basilio and his fellow university students simply want permission to open a school so they can teach and learn in Spanish.
That's it.
That is it. That is their grand petition.
But we have to understand why learning Spanish was such a massive deal back then. In the context of the colonial Philippines, the archipelago was divided by hundreds of different regional languages and dialects.
Okay, so a little fragmentation.
Exactly. Spanish was the language of the colonizer, yes, but it was also the only unifying language. It was the language of the courts, of commerce, and of the law.
So by keeping the local population from learning Spanish, the colonial government was effectively keeping them isolated.
Precisely.
Because if you can't speak the language of the law, you have no idea what your rights are. You can't communicate with the island next to yours. You are entirely dependent on the local friar or official to translate the world for you.
Which is a huge vulnerability.
Right, which means they can just lie to you constantly.
Exactly. Knowledge of the language was the ultimate tool for unity and legal self-defense. So, when these earnest, peaceful students politely petitioned to open a Spanish academy, how does the system respond?
The system flat out rejects it. The colonial authorities entirely deny this harmless, reasonable request. They completely crush the earnest hopes of these peaceful young students.
It's devastating.
And they don't just say no, they actively punish the students for daring to ask in the first place, eventually even arresting Basilio.
And this right here is the core thesis of Raizel's entire novel. This isn't just some minor plot point about a denied school permit. This is Raizel demonstrating to you, mechanism by mechanism, how a rigid system manufactures its own violent downfall.
By systematically blocking every single peaceful avenue.
Yes. So. When a system outright refuses to bend to gentle, reasonable, logical requests for improvement, it sends a very clear message to the populace.
That playing by the rules is a dead end.
Exactly. When you block the peaceful reformers, you don't stop the desire for change. You simply guarantee that the only path left to achieve change is violence. The colonial system, in its arrogance, is essentially handing the match to Simon.
They validate the accelerationist.
Yeah.
Which pushes the entire plot right to its absolute boiling point.
Yeah.
Because the peaceful path has failed, Summon's dark plan becomes viable.
Right.
He constructs a bomb, but he hides it inside this incredibly beautiful, ornate, jewel-encrusted lamp. And he arranges for this lamp to be gifted at a massive high society wedding.
A wedding that just happens to be packed with the governor general, the top friars, and all the most powerful, corrupt colonial officials in the entire country.
It's the ultimate devastating trap. The officials are sitting there celebrating their own wealth and power, completely oblivious to the suffering outside, while a literal bomb sits right in the center of their table.
It's such a tense setup.
So tense. The plan is that the lamp will explode, decapitating the entire colonial leadership in one massive strike. And that explosion is supposed to be the chaotic signal to trigger a nationwide bloody uprising.
But the bomb never goes off.
It fails. At the very last possible moment, the plot is discovered. The lamp is thrown into the river and the bomb is neutralized. Simon's entire life's work, this grand, cynical, accelerationist scheme, completely unravels in an instant.
Everything he worked for, just gone.
Gone. He is discovered, he is forced to flee into the mountains, and he is mortally wounded during his escape. He ends up taking refuge in the remote home of a good, deeply decent Filipino priest named Padre Florentino.
And, what's fascinating here is this final encounter between the dying, furious radical Simon and the peaceful, contemplative priest Padre Florentino. It serves as the ultimate moral and philosophical verdict of the novel. As he is dying, Simon asks the priest a really desperate question. Why did his plan fail? Why would God forsake his cause when his cause was ultimately about freeing the oppressed people from a terrible evil?
I mean, I expected the priest to offer some gentle comfort there, but Padre Florentino doesn't hold back at all.
No, he doesn't.
He essentially tells Simon, your plan failed because you tried to build a foundation of freedom out of hatred, manipulation, and innocent blood.
Mm-hmm.
And no righteous universe will ever bless a nation built on that kind of soil.
Florentino articulates Raizel's deepest, most complex philosophy here. He argues that seizing freedom through cruelty and sheer violence doesn't actually dismantle tyranny. It merely changes the faces of the tyrants.
Wow.
Yeah. If a population overthrows an oppressor using the oppressor's brutal methods, the oppressed simply become the new oppressors. The cycle of abuse just continues under a new flag.
But, I have to push back on Florentino's pacifism here because it almost sounds like a cop-out.
How do you mean?
Well, if a colonial system is actively murdering innocent people and denying them basic human rights, isn't telling the victims to just, quote unquote, be better people incredibly unfair? Is Reisel really saying they should just accept the abuse?
It's a vital question. And no, Reisel is absolutely not saying they should accept depression. But Florentino explains that true, lasting liberty must be deserved.
Deserved.
Yes. What he means is that a people must lift themselves up through education, through critical thinking, and through moral fortitude. You need a highly educated populace that understands its rights and refuses to be manipulated.
Okay, I see.
Burning a broken system to the ground with a bomb is fast, and frankly, it is emotionally satisfying in the short term, but building a society of decent, educated people who can actually sustain a fair democratic system after the smoke clears, that is incredibly hard, agonizingly slow, generational work.
Right.
But Rizal argues it is the only type of change that actually prevents the next dictator from stepping in.
That is an astonishingly brave narrative choice for an author to make. It
It really is.
would have been so much easier, so much more popular to just pick a clean, crowd-pleasing side, to write a manifesto saying violence is the only way and let the bomb go off, or to write a pure pacifist tract saying violence is always evil.
Exactly.
But Rizal refuses to give the reader an easy out. He makes you feel the crushing, undeniable weight of both arguments. He proves why Simon's rage is completely justified, but he refuses to light the bomb.
Which brings us out of the fiction and into the unbearably tragic real-world irony of this entire deep dive. Because Rizal didn't just write this as a thought experiment.
Huh.
He was desperately trying to warn the Spanish colonial government. For two entire novels, he meticulously laid out the psychology of a breaking point. He told them, if you keep blocking peaceful change, if you keep crushing the basilios of the world who just want to read and learn, you are going to create a nation of Simons who want to blow you up.
He literally gave them the exact psychological blueprint of their own destruction. He showed them the trap they were building for themselves. And how did the colonial government respond to this profound analytical warning?
They proved him completely right. In 1896, the colonial government arrested José Rizal and they put him in front of a firing squad.
It is staggering, the absolute blindness of power. By executing Rizal, the very man who used his genius to argue against a violent, bloody revolution, the man who argued that education was the only true path forward, the colonial government essentially validated Simon's cynicism.
They really did. The mechanism of martyrdom is powerful. By killing the most famous peaceful reformer, the government broadcast a loud, undeniable message to the entire Filipino populace.
That there's zero peaceful path left.
Exactly. If they will kill Rizal, they will kill anyone. And in doing so, they triggered the exact violent revolution they've been terrified of.
Wow.
The Philippine Revolution exploded shortly after his death. History proved that his fictional warning was entirely terrifyingly accurate.
To see someone map out the exact psychological trap of a society, beg everyone to avoid it, and then be killed by the very system walking directly into that exact trap, it just leaves you speechless.
He does.
So let's bring this back to you listening right now,
Yeah.
because these aren't just museum pieces or dusty facts trapped in the 19th century. This profound tension between reform and radicalization is alive in every single era.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about the systems in your own life. Whether you're navigating a deeply toxic workplace, a flawed community organization, or witnessing massive national political shifts. When a system constantly tells you, wait, be patient, not yet with yet, at what point does patience cross the line into complicity?
It's a tough question.
It is. And more importantly, how do you push back against a system that feels completely rigged without letting the anger warp you into the very monster you are trying to defeat?
That is the incredibly thin tightrope we all have to walk. It's the ultimate challenge, right? Holding on to your core character and your empathy when the environment around you is actively hostile to it.
And before we go, there is one final, incredibly beautiful detail from the source material that we just have to share.
Yes, beats do.
Despite all the fury, the explosive plots, the slurs, and the rage we've explored today, Rizal's absolute final act in the real world, right before he was marched to the firing squad, was to write a poem.
A beautiful poem.
And he hid this poem inside a small lamp, which is just a hauntingly beautiful callback to the climax of his novel. But unlike the lamp in El Filibusterismo, which contained a bomb fueled by pure hatred and vengeance, the poem he hid in his real lamp was a piece of pure, calm, perfect love for his country.
Wow.
Even at the very end, facing the ultimate injustice, there wasn't a single drop of hatred in it.
It is a breathtaking testament to his belief that character must ultimately conquer rage. And it leaves us with a provocative thought to carry forward today. Padre Florentino gave us that definitive verdict. True freedom requires a society to be highly educated and morally grounded to prevent the next tyranny from taking over. So, looking at the world around you today, how do modern societies measure up to that standard?
That's a great question.
Are we currently doing the hard, quiet work of educating ourselves and building character to be worthy of the freedoms we enjoy? Or are we taking those freedoms for granted, looking for fast, explosive solutions and risking the return of the very tyrannies we thought we left behind in history?
It really makes you look at that board game differently, doesn't it? When the rules keep changing and the board gets flipped over, maybe the answer isn't to set the whole table on fire. Maybe the hardest, bravest thing you can do is sit down, gather the pieces, and demand the long, hard work of building a better game. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.